Maine's June primary is drawing near, and today we bring you another in our series of Your Vote 2018 interviews with the candidates vying for their party's nominations in the race for governor and 2nd District congressional seat. In this series, we'll hear from all 14 primary candidates on a range of key issues. We'll also find out why each believes that they're the best choice to represent their party in the general election this fall. If you miss either of our candidate interviews in this hour, you can hear all 14 conversations at mainepublic.org/yourvote. You can also learn more about each of the candidates and see their positions broken down on an easy-to-use issues grid near the top of our Your Vote 2018 page. Today we'll hear from Jared Golden, one of three Democrats vying for the chance to challenge incumbent Republican Bruce Poliquin in Maine's 2nd Congressional District, and Betsy Sweet, one of seven Democrats in this year's gubernatorial primary. Golden is currently serving his 2nd term in the Maine House, where he is now the Assistant Majority Leader. He's a military veteran who served for 4 years in the U.S. Marines with deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan. He earned a bachelor's degree from Bates College and spoke with Maine Public's Mal Leary about why he stands out in the field of Democrats.
First thing I want to say is something that really sets us apart, I do think, is experience. I have a record of service in the legislature that I think is very important. It tells voters who I am and what I've stood for, a record they can verify. So they don't have to worry about whether or not I'm making promises. They can look and see that I've always stood by my word and fought for the issues that I have prioritized here. I think a few differences between us. One, people ask us, what will you prioritize? I often point out, having served 4 years in a divided government, you have to search for the issues that can be good and positive for your community and that you know you can work across the aisle on. So I've been talking a lot about infrastructure. The President of the United States says he wants to rebuild America and roads and bridges, and I think we can work with him on that. And it would bring in a lot of, I think, jobs in the constructions and in building roads and bridges, and so I'd like to work with him on that. That's one thing. But certainly I think I've come out quite strongly in support of Medicare for All, and talked a lot about standing by labor and trying to strengthen unions at a time when I think the economy is unbalanced and unfair to workers.
We'll get into more specifics on some of those later, but the polls continue to show that jobs is the most important concern for voters in the 2nd District, particularly. What could you do, or what would you do as a member of Congress to help grow the economy?
I'm always skeptical when I see politicians say that they're going to create jobs, that they're going to go somewhere and put in a piece of legislation and revive some kind of industry or bring a new one here. I think that it is far more complex than that, and often it is the private sector and the marketplace that drives things. So for me, it's a focus on how do we help small businesses. Often government's role, in my opinion, is to make the investments that it's very clear small businesses can't afford to make themselves. Again, getting back to infrastructure, they can't afford to rebuild roads and bridges, but it's very important to the work that they do. That's one good example. I think about big monopolies, large companies that are dominating the market. What can we do to help level the playing field so that small businesses can compete?
What do you see as the most pressing issue facing the country, and what would you do to address it?
I think that certainly we have to talk about the culture of our own political leadership and discourse. We've become very divided. I think it's scary. It scares me. I think it scares a lot of people, and I want to offer a different kind of leadership in that regard. If you wanted a specific policy, Mal, I guess I would say, given what happened in 2017, we have to find a solution to health care in this country. It's costly, and we have a lot of people still that don't have access to it.
Now, voters participating in this June primary election will be using ranked choice voting for the first time. Assuming that you plan to vote for yourself in that first slot position, who will be your second and third choice in this primary?
You know, I went to a house party that I had, invited some people, and someone asked a woman after spending 30 minutes with me, "So you're going to vote for Jared?" And she said, "You can't ask me that. It's private what I do in that booth." I'm going to vote for both of them. I can tell you that because of ranked choice voting. I haven't decided who gets my second and third vote yet.
Let's move on to other issues. Maine's a graying state, and the 2nd District's aging even faster than the state as a whole. Do you support any specific changes to Medicare or Social Security?
I think that Social Security has fallen behind in regards to the rising cost of living in this country. Food is more expensive. Housing is more expensive. Insurance coverage and medications. So if there's anything I would change about Social Security, I'd say the benefit, the monthly payment to folks that are living on a very tight fixed income needs to rise to match those rising costs and inflation. In terms of Medicare, I'm not supporting any rollback or privatization of that. That's a promise and one I intend to fight for. If I would change anything, I would move us in the direction of expanding towards universal coverage by lowering the age of eligibility to 55. I think that could help small business owners by taking some of their more expensive and costly employees off of their hands and putting them into Medicare. That should also help lower premiums for their other employees. And more importantly, when I'm out in places like Rumford and I talk to people been working in the mill all their lives, they say, I'm 58 years old, and I've been working in the mill basically all of my life. I could retire tomorrow. I've got the egg nest to do it, but I need the health care, so I'm going to have to stay working for the next 7 years until I hit 65. So let's lower the age of eligibility and give those people the opportunity to retire because they're ready and they've earned it, and time for someone else to step up and have an opportunity to take that job.
Right now, as you know, the Social Security tax caps out at about $127,000. Anything above that, you're not being taxed for Social Security. Should you be, particularly since you're talking about some expansions here that are going to cost money?
Well, I pay into every dollar that I earn. So I call that a loophole for individuals that are making over $128,000 a year. And certainly I think that they ought to pay on every dollar the same as I and everyone else that makes less money than that pays on every dollar they earn. So yes, I would support that.
President Trump's imposed tariffs on steel and aluminum, and some main companies are being hurt by that. Do you support these tariffs, and why or why not?
I want to talk to steel workers, the steel industry, before I would answer that question fully. I want to know, are those tariffs going to help you? Are they going to help this industry and help your jobs, help strengthen the steel industry in America? I think that it matters who we apply those to. Certainly, you got to go after countries that have been abusing a global marketplace to put American steel at a disadvantage. I think more or just as important as what we can do in terms of protective measures is what can we do to be positive about helping steel in America. So we want to rebuild America. Let's put the priority on Buy America, on using American-made products and American-made steel first, and on making that big investment in infrastructure that will use that steel. I think that's a great way to help those workers as well.
Well, we already know that some of these tariffs are going to directly impact jobs in Maine. Bath Iron Works gets most of its steel from other countries. It's not from the United States.
Well, I guess what can we do to make sure that American steel can be made at a competitive rate so that they can start using American steel? Because wouldn't we all rather see American steel in American naval ships? I know I would.
Name one issue on which you see yourself voting against the wishes of your party leadership, and why.
Are you talking about Congress? Because
yes.
I know you've seen me do it in the Maine State Legislature.
We're talking Congress because that's where you want to get elected.
I think we can talk about potentially certain trade deals and other things where I think I'm prepared and ready to go against them on that. I can imagine scenarios where they didn't want me to work across the aisle, maybe on something like infrastructure. They wanted to hold out. But if it's what's best for Maine, then I'm going to do that.
Do you intend to hold what we would call traditional town hall style meetings to hear from your constituents? And if so, would you put any restrictions on the people who attend those meetings?
No. Now, last year I did 16 town halls out of 21 that state Democratic leaders held all around the state. We put no restrictions on who could come or on what questions they could ask. I enjoyed that very much. I'm not afraid to stand in a room with people and disagree on the issues and constantly keep coming back to see how we can find the things that we do agree on and how we can work together. I've already held town halls in this primary campaign. I think I've got about 13 between now and June 12th, and I'm not going to stop if I win this primary. I'll be out doing them immediately in the general election.
How do they help you in terms of understanding the concerns of your potential constituents?
Vastly. People come. Now, in Orland the other night, I had a town hall. I spoke and introduced myself for 5 minutes. The questions and answers went on for over an hour. People's hands just didn't stop going up. They had so many questions, so many things they wanted to tell me. It's a great way to hear people's perspectives, hear them raise personal concerns. Here's what's happening to me and how it's impacting my life. What are you going to do, you know, if this vote comes up? Would you support that or not? It's just, it's so important to do that.
Recreational use of marijuana is now legal in Maine. Do you support Congress legalizing recreational use nationally, and why or why not?
You know, in the 2016 referendum, I was very aware of the fact that in 2014, there was a local referendum in Lewiston that rejected it. We didn't want that at the municipal level. I don't think it's a great solution. I'm not involved in public service to try and move forward on saying let's make marijuana more available to people. I view it very much like alcohol. I think we all recognize the pros and cons. There's plenty of cons out there for alcohol as well. Some people say more. More importantly to me is the state has voted to by referendum to move forward with legal marijuana, and I'm going to make sure that the federal government doesn't stand in the way of what the people of Maine have said that they want. And doubling down even deeper, the medical marijuana program in Maine is incredibly important to a lot of people's health. It's been available in this state for a long time, and I'm going to make sure the federal government doesn't do anything to disrupt that.
But should Congress take action? Because right now we have the situation, it's legal under state law, it's still illegal under federal law, and you could be arrested for even possessing marijuana under federal law right now.
Again, I think that what's important to me at the federal level is that they're not impacting states' rights on this issue. So a great example of this is with veterans. The VA will not work closely with veterans who are using medical marijuana because of those federal laws, and I'd like to see legislation passed that eases those restrictions to make sure that veterans who are using medical marijuana, maybe for post-traumatic stress, can still go to the VA, be open and honest with their doctor about what they're using for treatment without risking the loss of federal health care treatment through the VA or other VA benefits.
Congress is considering a number of gun violence-related measures right now. Where do you stand on each of the following proposals and your explanation of your position? Raising the age to purchase a rifle to 21.
I don't think that's necessary. I won't support that.
And why?
I don't see any evidence here in Maine that that's driving gun violence or some kind of problem. And I think certainly we can, with proper training and supervision, people at the age of 18 can handle a rifle.
There's a proposal to ban the sale of semi-automatic weapons.
Tough to define what a semi-automatic weapon is, Mal. Do you want to get more specific?
Could you try to get more specific there? Because obviously it's a measure that is pending before Congress. And in some cases they define individual weapon types like an right. AR-15. And other times it's much broader definition.
Yep. There are so many different weapons that are semi-automatic, pistols, different forms of shotguns and rifles, AR-15s. So, you know, if the question is, assault weapons, which again is hard to define, I often think it's the tools and the things you attach to them that make them more assault style in nature. I think we're getting closer. But for me, I think everyone's searching for this silver bullet to fix this problem of gun violence in this country, and I don't believe that banning AR-15s is necessarily going to solve that. It's a complex problem. It's going to take a very complex solution.
What about banning the sale of large ammunition magazines, which is also a pending measure?
I'm ready to talk about that and consider supporting it. As a leader in the legislature, I voted as a ledge council member to move forward on debate about whether or not we should limit magazine capacity to 10 rounds. I carried 30-round magazines in my M16 in the Marines when I went into combat. When we were training, we tended to shoot in tens, three sets of three, plus one on that final grouping. And so I think that 10 rounds is something that makes sense to me. I don't know why you would need much more than that, and I don't necessarily have a problem with that kind of a limitation.
President Trump continues to insist on spending billions of dollars to build a border wall with Mexico. While there are other pressing infrastructure needs, some of which you mentioned earlier, roads, bridges, high-speed internet access, could you rank in order of importance? How would you place those three? That is, roads, internet access, or the border wall?
roads and internet access first, border wall last.
Do you think that there's financing available to do that? Because right now we seem to be spending the money on the border wall, and there still has yet to be an infrastructure program for any of the others.
Yeah, I think we need to rebuild America, not box it in necessarily. So I think that we've got our priorities backwards in that regard. You know, I worked on the Senate Homeland Security Committee staff for 2 years. I think you know that. I don't think that we're necessarily listening to those agencies, because I haven't heard them say that they want a big brick-and-mortar wall. They use fencing. They use technologies like drones and other things and patrols. And there are many, I think, ways to secure our borders that don't have to represent some kind of physical, massive border wall.
But in order to do infrastructure, we need more resources. Are you willing to support a federal gas tax?
I'm actually more interested in what is the future of federal and state funding models for transportation. You know, I was on the Transportation Committee here in the Maine State Legislature, and as fuel efficiency standards go up, we get less of a return on the gas tax. And so many states, and I think probably at the federal level too, there's a discussion about what is the funding mechanism of the future.
Would you support legislation that would fire Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller?
Could you repeat that question?
Yeah. Would you support legislation that would fire the special prosecutor, Robert Mueller?
Not unless he had done something wrong that warranted his firing. Otherwise, no. He needs to do his job. And I think right now he's doing it.
The flip question, of course, is would you support legislation that protects his position? Because that is also kicking around in Congress.
If someone is trying to meddle with that ongoing investigation, then yes. But I would not do it just for political purposes. I think it has to be because it's very clear that there's an effort to tamper with or shut down the investigation without cause.
Would you support Congress, or what would you say Congress should do in response to Russian efforts to influence our elections? We clearly have studies now that show they have tried to influence elections in the past.
I think we have to explore further sanctions. Send a very clear, strong message to them that they were not going to let anybody mess with our democracy and tamper with our election system. But we also have to be proactive in terms of making investments in protecting our own election infrastructure. Cybersecurity is something that Congress has been trying to work on for many years, and I think there's probably still a lot of work there that needs to be done to make sure that we're protecting this country's grid, our internet, and protecting us from cyber attacks that ultimately I think could be truly damaging to our elections. And I think that we have to start talking about how we regulate industries like out in Silicon Valley, regulating tech and Facebook and other forms of social media to make sure that they're not being abused to have a negative impact on our democracy.
Such as disclosing Facebook ads, where they're coming from, who's paying for them, that sort of thing?
I would love to say yes. Let's have the same requirements for reporting on online Facebook ads as we do for television ads. And on that note, let's go even further and improve the reporting and transparency for all forms of political advertisements.
The drug crisis continues to claim at least a person a day in Maine. What specific policies would you advocate for in Congress to address that problem?
Increase reimbursement rates to healthcare service providers that provide mental health and behavioral health, substance abuse, counseling programs. I think that they have not seen an increase in reimbursements for the work that they do in many years. More treatment and prevention is the key to me.
And more law enforcement? I mean, that's always the third leg of the stool that people talk about.
I certainly want to make sure that we have always given the resources to law enforcement departments that they need. We should try as hard as we can to match their requests.
Unless you have strong majorities in both the House and Senate, you're going to have to reach across the aisle to ensure that anything you want to see passed gets passed. How will you do that?
I've got a track record of doing it, Mal. In 4 years in the Maine State Legislature, it's been always the Senate controlled by Republicans, the House controlled by Democrats. Governor Paula Page is a Republican. He vetoes many things. I have had, in total, 11 pieces of legislation that I have introduced that have found their way into law. I did that by working across the aisle. last week or 2 weeks ago, a pilot program to provide mental health care to veterans who have fallen through the cracks of the VA system launched, and we're going to be providing care to veterans in Maine hospitals as a result. You know, I helped create new state employee positions for case management to help get veterans into the VA healthcare system or match them up with their benefits. There are 16 beds being built for homeless veterans at the VA hospital. That's a bill that I introduced that ultimately they ended up getting tax credits through Maine State Housing for. Passenger rail, working on expanding that to Lewiston, Auburn. I think you know about the bill that I passed to help first responders diagnosed with post-traumatic stress have that treated like a workplace injury so that they're able to get access to workers' compensation to help them get back on their feet. I've gone on and on here now, but I don't have to tell you how I'm going to do it because I've already shown you how I do it.
Do you support exploratory oil drilling off the East Coast, particularly off the coast of Maine?
No.
And why?
Because that is way too important to our economy, the health of our marine resources, of our environment. Everyone knows that Maine's economy depends very heavily upon the health of our environment. We need to protect it. We've seen what these oil spills do to marine resources and economies, and it's just too big of a risk to me, especially because this state has been trying for a long time now to move in the direction of renewable energy, offshore wind and solar and other forms of renewable energy. So no, the juice isn't worth the squeeze, in my opinion. We can't take that risk.
Do you support protecting the federal status of the Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument, and why?
I don't think it's under risk. Secretary Zinke made very clear that it was off the list, and so I think that issue is largely settled.
Although Congress has yet to act on the proposal to make it a park, which is the next step that folks want to see happen, who have supported the creation of this monument.
I think that's going to be a larger question that the entire state of Maine is going to have to rule, you know, weigh in on. We have a national monument. It was only designated in August of 2016. It's just now really getting up and running for our first full season. We just saw the governor has finally put up signs showing people how to access that monument. And so I don't think we should hurry to move in the direction of making it a national park. Let's see how this works for the state of Maine. Let's see how it works for the communities in that area. And maybe in the future we can have that discussion. But again, similar to how we had to have a statewide debate about whether or not we wanted a monument, the same will apply in the future for a park.
Jared Golden, one of three Democrats vying for a chance to challenge incumbent Republican Bruce Poliquin in Maine's 2nd District this fall. He spoke with Maine Public's Mal Leary. Up next, Betsy Sweet is a longtime lobbyist who served as director of the Maine Women's Lobby and the Maine Commission for Women. She currently heads Moose Ridge Associates, a lobbying firm in Augusta. Sweet has not held elected office. She told Maine Public's Fred Bever that she's the only Democrat who's running as a so-called clean candidate.
In my years of advocacy at the State House, I've seen that the influence of money and special interests and special interest PACs is affecting everything that we are trying to do, whether it's health care, addressing the opioid crisis, passing a minimum wage, economic development. Money in politics talks. And I helped write the law in 1996, and I have seen that it just gets worse and worse. So I think we are at a critical time in Maine's history and in our national history where people know and understand that government has gotten out of our hands and into the hands of special interests. And I'm the only candidate on the Democratic side who is not willing to take those interests and wants to address all the issues that we face from the values of Maine people, everyday, ordinary Maine people.
So what is the biggest challenge that you see facing Maine? And as governor, how would you respond?
I think the biggest challenge we have is health care, providing health care. Our businesses cannot compete globally without health care. I was just at a logging forum the other day, and you know they were talking about Canadian tariffs and stuff for competing with logging contractors and wood manufacturers. And the number one reason they can't compete is Canadian companies are not spending 30% of their income and their profits on health care. So we have to do that. And so I am for a single payer universal health care system that covers everybody. So obviously, Maine Care expansion is the first thing we need to do. We have single payer in this state already for everyone over 65 and everyone under a certain income level. It's everybody in the middle who's paying for health care. And we're not just paying for care. We're paying for the profits of the insurance companies, the big drug companies, big pharma, you know, the corporate healthcare structure that we have. So we're paying for all that as well as all the uninsured people. So that just isn't sustainable. Now, I know that people say, Maine, we can't do it alone. You know, we have to wait for the federal government. Well, we're not going to get this from the federal government anytime soon. So I'm already working with people to look at a New England compact in which we can work with some or all of the New England states to actually create a single-payer system for New England and that we can lead the country.
Polls still show that jobs are the biggest concern for voters mm-hmm. here in Maine. As governor, what would you do to help grow the economy?
From the worker side, I think we have to start paying people a wage that they can live on. So I support a $15 minimum wage. And that money, people that make $15 an hour or less at this point, that money goes directly back into our economy. I think expanding Medicaid will bring $500 million into this economy, into our healthcare sector. That's a huge issue. But in terms of attracting business and attracting job growth in this state, we have got to change from having our economic development plans being chasing big manufacturing companies out of state and hope that they're going to come. They're not coming. We need to grow where we're planted. There are some amazing opportunities, I think, that we have in technology, in solar energy, in energy development, wave energy that and out in the ocean, which is incredibly new and upcoming, that create good, high-paying technological jobs that we can then we have to have the workforce. We don't have the workforce right now, enough of the workforce that's educated, that has enough credentialing to go into those kind of jobs. So we have to do that. I think also we have to look at the workforce. We have got to open the welcome mat to people to come into the state. We're losing 7,000 workers a year, and we have got to, for both immigrants, and we have to make it attractive to live in the state to new people. I also think, obviously, getting high-speed broadband all over the state is critical. You can't do business anywhere in the state, and I don't care what dirt road you're at the end of in northern Maine, or if you're trying to sell blueberries, or if you're trying to, you know, do higher education. We can't do it without broadband. And when we talk to young people about what would bring them to Maine, having access to broadband is a huge issue for them. So I think the other thing is we have a lot of potential with our natural resources. I think I actually just talked to this great company that is called Ecovative, and they're replacing styrofoam by using the mycelium underneath the mushrooms so they can grow styrofoam, and it's completely compostable. So Dell Computers using it, Crate and Barrel's using it, and then just when you get that packaging, instead of having a half-life of a gazillion years, you can just throw it in your garden. Now, they are looking for places to manufacture this, and now they're looking at making buoys in the ocean from this stuff, because the styrofoam buoys in the ocean are adding to ocean acidification. They're making our waters warmer, hurting our fishing and lobstering industries. So that's a technology that, you know, I always say it's great. It means a great place to grow mushrooms. It's dark, it's cold, and we're full of all the stuff that they need to grow, right? So anyway, I think there's those kinds of innovative technologies and new industries that we can look at. And lastly, let me say, I think we need to grow where we're planted, literally. The only young people that are moving into the state right now are young farmers. And as a state, we do nothing to help them, nothing. And so we have this opportunity. You know, you see it in the craft food market, in the farm-to-table market, and when you see it in our craft brewery market. There are extraordinary young people that are doing this amazing work and revitalizing our rural areas and revitalizing our rural communities, having destination food stops in the middle of nowhere where they're bringing economic development. So if we could, as a state, actually have our economic development start there and grow from the bottom up, I think we have a huge opportunity. So I'm proposing that we have regional development authorities in different regions of the state, communities of the state, where they have not only the ideas, but they actually have the dollars. Take the dollars away from Augusta and give it to our regions to actually do economic development that makes sense to them and works. Because I think people closest to the problem are much closer to the solution. That's been my experience for all my 35 years of work. So we need to get people in Millinocket, for example, or in Caribou, figuring out what's good for that area. And it's going to be different than what's good for Elliott and South Portland, you know, and that's okay. We can have different strategies.
Turning to the interesting dynamics of this primary election, as you know, Maine voters will be using ranked choice voting.
Yes.
Assuming that you'll rank yourself first,
mm-hmm.
who would be your second or third choice, and why?
So My second choice would be Mark Eaves, and I've worked with Mark for a lot of years. I actually trained him. I think he would tell you the same thing when he first got to the legislature. But I think his experience as the speaker and also his values, I think, are similar to the ones that Maine has. And I think any one of us would be certainly a much better governor than what we've had for the last 8 years. But I think I would be number one, and Mark would be my number two.
Maine has a pretty low gun violence rate. But about half of domestic violence homicides in the state involve guns, as you know. Should the state's gun laws be changed, and how?
Yes. We need to have background checks, universal background checks with no loopholes. We need to have a waiting period. We need to have a ban on assault weapons and high-capacity ammunition and guns that use that. I think And mostly what we have to have is a conversation. I support the right of hunters. I support the right of people having guns for their own safety. But what I think the most important thing, I think I'm the only one who can address this positively, because I'm the only one that doesn't take money from special interests. We are so afraid in this state to have a conversation about guns. We can't even have a conversation. I talk to people all the time. You know, I'm not an expert on guns, but I'm an expert on my kids' safety. And my kids actually don't care whether this mass shooting was in Florida or in Las Vegas or where it is. They own that fear, because we don't know where it's going to happen next. And so we have to come together. Imagine if as a state we had a conversation, we brought people from all sides of this issue to the table based on how do we keep our kids safe instead of what our funding source was. The NRA and other gun organizations have so dominated the conversation by their money in politics, by either supporting politicians or spending vast amounts of money against other politicians, that people are afraid to talk about it. So I think that we can follow the lead of these amazing, courageous young people and really have the conversation and make it about safety and common sense. And I think Mainers are full of both of those things. And I think we can make real headway on that. But again, I think we can't do it until we get money into politics. And I'm the only one in this race who's 100% sure not to take any money from them.
Maine is currently enjoying a low unemployment rate, but still 44th in the nation in median household income. How would you help Maine workers earn more money?
Yeah. Well, I think I said already, I would absolutely support a $15 minimum wage. You know, we cannot – I don't think there's a person in Maine – who believes that someone should work 40 hours a week and not be able to put food on the table and a roof over their head. I have worked for 30-some-odd years in the mental health field, helping to try and get community-based mental health services available to people all over the state. And right now, we have an incredible crisis in a worker shortage. And the reason is because we're not paying people enough, because the state contracts don't allow us to pay people a living wage. And so people can make more money now flipping hamburgers for McDonald's than or working at Walmart than they can taking care of our most vulnerable citizens. So one, if we have a minimum wage that is actually livable, and if we had index minimum wage, we'd be at like $22 an hour. But I think to start with $15 an hour. So I think that's a piece. I think another piece is we have to look at our tax structure. You know, this administration has put millions of dollars into the hands of the wealthiest Mainers with the idea that it's going to trickle down. Well, we all know that it doesn't trickle down. So we are seeing those investments and those high those high profits and stuff are going overseas, or they're going into the pockets of CEOs. They're not going to, as they used to, back into investments in the business to grow the business, grow more workers. So I think we have to look at those tax structures as well. The last thing is I think we have to have a champion for Maine. You know, we have become the butt of late-night TV shows, and there's a lot of people who say, oh, Maine, that's that crazy guy up there, right? And so that actually has an impact on who comes to Maine, both to live and work, but also as visitors and tourism. I think we have to celebrate everything that is great about Maine, both internally in our state and externally, so people want to come here, want to live here, and want to make our communities vibrant and help us. So, yes.
So electricity costs here in Maine are the lowest in New England, but that is a backhanded compliment.
Yes.
Because they are among the highest in the country. Mm-hmm. So as governor, would you try to lower energy costs? And if
absolutely.
So, how?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's a unfortunately, it's not a quick fix. I mean, I think there's some things we can do to lower energy costs right away. I think there's smart metering. There's, so where we use our electricity at off-peak times, and there's some ways to do that. I think we've got to turn away from fossil fuels, and we have to look at alternative, regenerative, sustainable energy. We have the resources to do this. I am very excited. There's a Denmark has just commercialized this incredible pod that's about 21 feet long and has paddles on either side of it all the way down. And it just floats on top of the ocean. And that kinetic energy of those paddles alone can generate power for 4,000 homes. So I think we have an incredible opportunity to do that. We have to look at grid and distribution. And I think the state has to get more involved in that. And we have to stop, you know, the bill that just passed this session that's going to charge people who are producing solar energy on their own homes, it's going to tax them. I mean, that is the reverse incentive. So we have got to look at ways to get fossil fuel free. And then we have to, you know, it's going to take a little bit investment in the beginning, but then our costs are going to go lower and lower and lower.
Looking at trying to attract new businesses to Maine, I imagine energy cost is one issue, but a lot has been made over the years about tax incentives, pine tree zones, TIFs, et cetera. Do you see these programs as effective economic development tools or maybe as corporate welfare?
They haven't been effective economic tools. You know, this is one of my issues I've been working on for about 20 years. We give more money in tax exemptions as a state. We spend more money on tax exemptions as a state than we do on our state budget, than we actually put out in dollars. Now, some of those are things that you and I would agree with, food and, you know, and a couple of other things. But most of them are special corporate tax breaks that have been given to corporations to create jobs, to do something. And we never go back and say, hey, did we actually do this? Did this actually work? The Better program was a tax incentive, was a tax break for allegedly small businesses. And you know where that ended up getting being spent? That ended up going to Walmart and Home Depot for shelving. Small businesses couldn't access it. But we never even asked that question. So I do not think that tax incentives, certainly the way we've structured them now, have anything to do with helping grow our economy. Now, what I think we need to do is take the money, you know, that we have that's enclosed in that tax exempt pool, and use it again, as I said, in the regional development authorities, where people can use that and say, okay, what is it that you need? I met an incredible woman who was a cheesemaker in Skowhegan. She makes this incredible smoked ricotta cheese, which I never even knew there was such a thing, but it's great. But I asked her, I said, what are the challenges for your business? And she said, I can't sell any of my food across state lines because I don't have this $35,000 machine that the federal government requires. And I'm never going to be able to afford it. So I said, well, are there other cheesemakers around? She said, yeah, there's a lot of people who could use it, but we don't have the opportunity because none of us have $35,000. So just economic development terms, imagine if the state would capitalize that machine and then charge people to use it, right? But then they could, she said she could hire two people immediately if she was able to have access to such a machine. So I think there's things that we can do like that they sound local, they sound small, but that is where all the energy and the enthusiasm and the skill is in our workforce right now. So I think we have to move it away from the halls of Augusta and consultants and, you know, special reports and whatever, and get it back to the people who actually know what's going on in their communities and what might work.
Now, looking about rather than corporate welfare, at human welfare,
Yes.
Temporary assistance for needy families and the various other components of Maine's welfare offerings. Is it too generous? Is it falling short? Is it just right? How would you change it?
Well, let me just step up to the 35,000-foot view, first of all. We've got to stop judging and making enemies out of people who need assistance, right? This administration has been disgustingly brilliant at saying, oh, you have a problem? It's that single mother over there with her three kids. She's the problem. It's that person who's on food stamps for 3 months while they are in the winter when they can't work. That's the problem. So we have to take away from demonizing. We have to stop demonizing people who need assistance. That's number one. Two, we have to start doing things that work, right? We know that kicking people off of health care, kicking people off of assistance, kicking people off of food stamps does nothing except demonize them further and create bigger problems for our local communities and our churches and our, you know, people who are hospitals and our jails, right? So it's just wrongheaded, and it's all based in a meanness factor. Now, I do think we have some opportunity to make some changes. We have to look at what are the real paths out of poverty. So parents as partners, you know, the parents as scholars programs that actually give training to people with a real pathway is, I think, something we need to switch our investments towards that. But I also have a new idea that I would – right now, if you come in and you need assistance, you're full of shame and judgment from other people and you hold that. And then the worker, the caseworker, the person on the other side, their job – they've been told their job is to make sure you get as little as possible. And so they have a whole book of regulations that say if you dotted the I on Thursday and you're supposed to do it on Tuesday, you get nothing. And so meanwhile, at the end, right, more people are in poverty. We have more children hungry than ever before. It's not working. Imagine if we – and empowered the workers on that in the front lines to be more like someone's coach. And we gave them, let's say, a flexible fund of, let's say, I'm just making this amount of money up, but let's say we gave them $10,000. And if you came in for services, perhaps you need childcare for your kids. Perhaps I need steel-toed boots. Perhaps somebody else needs one more college credit. Perhaps somebody else needs new teeth. Perhaps somebody else needs transportation. But we all don't need all of it. So this fund that the worker has, the caseworker, would be a flexible fund to say, okay, what is your individual path in your individual community out of poverty? And we set benchmarks and goals, and we actually make it work so that people get out of poverty. We have a worker shortage. We need workers. So those people who can work, it needs to be a path. And then the worker, instead of becoming the enemy, becomes your coach and your encourager and then helps you get past all the various lumps. And they're different for everybody and they're different in different parts of the state. I think that's the kind of incentive and practical thing that we can actually get done to help everybody actually find a real path out of poverty.
So I know that you already said that you want to expand Medicaid as the voters approved. How would you pay for it?
So I think we are already paying for not having it big time. We are paying in the hospitals are paying for it in their charity care costs. The failure to have behavioral health services, mental health services, we are paying for it in our jail costs. We are also paying, you and I, in the profits for the insurance companies, for big pharma. So I think, first of all, for Medicaid expansion right now, there is the money there. There's depending on who you talk to, between $150 and $200 million unspent in the Medicaid account. Now, first of all, we can ask how is that possible in a state that has 25% of our kids going to bed hungry every night, but that's another discussion. But anyway, so I think we have money to get started and to get going in the Medicaid expansion situation. But I think we then have to look at where is it that we can find dollars that we are currently spending that would be saved if we had full coverage? So again, we have to start looking at, you know, one of the frustrations in working on the budget in the state for 35 years is we have things in all these silos, right? So if we save money over here by having healthcare and we save money in the jails, well, those are two different committees that look at that. There's two different, you know, we don't connect those dots. And I think we have to start connecting those dots and we're going to find some money there. But then I think we have to look at our priorities, right? Again, we spent way more than it would cost us for healthcare on giving tax breaks to the wealthiest Mainers in the state. I would shift those priorities and make sure that we use those to make sure that we pay for health care, make sure that our kids aren't hungry. I think we have had this whole idea for a long time that government should be like a business. I don't think government should be like a business. I think government should be like a family, and we have to take care of our family.
Maine is experiencing a teacher shortage. Hmm. How would you incent more Mainers to get into teaching?
Well, first of all, I would insist on a base salary of $40,000 for just as a starting pay for teachers all over the state. So that's one. And two, I think we have to get back to education that actually allows teachers to teach and allows students to really learn. We have to get away from this whole idea that you have to teach to the test and the standardized testing that has done nothing but make teachers frustrated, make kids hate school, and make parents really frustrated. I'm the parent of three public school kids who have gone through our public schools, and those standardized tests did nothing for my kids except make them feel terrible.
Sure. So does the state pay its fair share of local education? If
no.
not, how far should it go?
No, I mean, first of all, I think we have to fund the 55% of education that we have voted on twice now in the state and that the people have asked for. And we can't, you know, what happened last year with that referendum was awful. So, yes, I think we have to pay for our share. And we have to look at ways to do this because, you know, again, traveling around the state, a lot of our candidate forums are held in schools. And the difference between the schools that we see in Wells and Kennebunk and Cape Elizabeth and in other parts of the state, you know, it's shocking. I have to say, it's shocking. My kid at Halldale, where my kids went, you know, it's a shocking difference, both in terms of the physical structure, but also in terms of the opportunities and the that they have. So a kid's education in Maine should not depend on their zip code. And we have to figure out how to make that better. One thing we have to do is restore revenue sharing. You know, the governor has cut revenue sharing so that not only did we not pay for the 55% of education, but then the money that localities have to actually do their jobs, right, has been cut. So their property taxes are going up, which is one of the most difficult things that people I talk to. It's one of the things they, you know, they have the most difficulty and the hardest time paying. A lot of people on fixed incomes, a lot of our elderly citizens, you know, it's really a problem. So we've got to look at a better way. You know, 55% would be a great start. And then I think we have to work with municipal leaders and with our educators to say, okay, what is a fair way to look at this distribution of resources, and how do we make sure that kids everywhere have access to high quality education?
The referendum process, is it working as intended? Would you consider changes?
I think it's sad that we resort to referendums so much. I would hope that we would use a lot less of them if we could actually get a governor and a legislature that could work together with the will of the people. And again, getting away from special interests. I think when we have a clean elections governor, we're not as beholden to the special interests. So I think every referendum, for example, that we voted on this time, minimum wage, expanding Medicaid, fair taxation to pay for education, all were things that could not get passed in the legislature, but people who care about them knew that the values of Maine people were reflected in those policy options. So I think that it works okay the way it is. The thing that doesn't work is when those referendums are passed by the people and they come back to the legislature and they have the opportunity to be either overturned or significantly changed. What people say matters, and what the voters say should be sacrosanct. It used to be that way. It isn't anymore. And I think that's the thing that's broken, not the referendum process.
Any specific action you could take to make it more effective?
You know, I think there's a thing. There was a lot of conversation this time around in the legislature about, you know, if the people vote on a referendum, that unless there is some, you know, gross harm that we can't live with, that, you know, it's a couple of years before the legislature could tinker with it. I think we can look at some of those things. I think there's, you know, some of that, but I think basically it works pretty well if we can just stop the legislature from overturning what the people did.
I want to talk about polarization in politics. There's a theory out there that right now it's best just to play to your base, right? Elected officials keep their supporters happy and loyal, rather than sort of reaching out, looking for compromise or building coalitions that could alienate the base. Do you agree with that?
No.
As an approach?
No.
How would you address that trend?
Yeah, no. Yeah, I think it's one of the most disturbing things that is happening in our politics. And I want to say, not to sound like a broken record, but I think underneath that, appealing to the base is more really appealing to your donors. And when we look at who they're appealing to the people who fund their campaigns. And this is true on both sides. This is not just one party or the other. So I think, one, getting back to our common values. You know, as I go around the state, I've traveled all over the state, as I talk to people, even in the referendum process, we can see that people actually, we have pretty common set of values as Mainers. You know, we work hard. We think people should be taken care of. We think people deserve a hand up when they're in trouble. You know, we have a pretty – things should be fair. People, you know, everyone should share in our common good. We have a pretty significant shared set of values. The problem is we've gotten into this, I think, donor war, and that's where we've lost it. So I think the most important thing is to have relationships. And I want to say that that's one of the reasons I'm running. For 35 years as an advocate for nonprofit, social service, vulnerable people, environmental organizations, the only way I've been able to get anything done, you know, and I helped pass the first Family Medical Leave Act in the country, our first clean elections law, the only way we've been able to do those things is to actually work across the aisle, work with all parties, Republican parties, the Democratic Party. And I've lived through every combination. I've lived through a Republican governor with a Democratic legislature, a Democratic governor with a Republican legislator, all three-way split, independent governor, you know. So I've done it in all of those combinations. and really is about relationships. It's really about talking and appealing to people's common values and getting away from the labels. And I think it would make a huge difference if we had a leader, a governor, who would actually not play into those politics, but would say, no, we're going to do what's best for the Maine people, not what's best for our donors, not what's best for your political base, but what's best. And we're going to bring the people who are being affected by the problem into the solution. I think people always say, you know, what are you going to do in your first day or your first, you know, and as a governor? First thing I would do is bring every legislator in, no matter what party, and say, why are you here? Why are you working on this? Every legislator in this building I've found over the years comes here because they think they can help the state of Maine. Now, that we may differ very much on how we do that or how we see that, but that's why they're here. So I think it's all about relationships, and it's all about taking the time to listen and to be curious about other people's positions and not do name-calling. My goal is to call people in to solve a problem, not to call people out based on their labels.
Is transparency, government transparency, an issue in your campaign? Do you think it's an important one for people in the state to
1,000%.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Absolutely. And again, that's another huge thing. It's one of the reasons I decided to run is because we don't have any transparency. You know, it's 35 years ago when I started, it was true that most things were done in the back rooms and we didn't have any idea what was happening and it was sort of presented at the last minute. We did a big shift and we had a lot of work and a lot of turmoil to make sure that we got things out in the open, particularly in the Appropriations Committee and the budget process, but for many issues. And now we're in a situation where the budget is done by four people in a back room. Commissioners aren't allowed to come talk to the committees of jurisdiction, so they can't even talk about what's going on in front of in their committees. So legislators have to make decisions based on no information or information only from paid people on either side or both sides. You know, so we absolutely need transparency. This is our government. We own it. And I think because of money in politics, we don't get to see what's happening. I think the people, you know, one of the things I'm interested in is the legislature now meets from 8 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon, or 5 depending. What if the legislature met from 12 in the afternoon till 8 at night, so that they met in session during from 12 to 4, and then from 4 to 8 is when they held their public hearings, so people who worked for a living could actually come and have their input heard at a committee on a bill or a particular piece of legislation. You know, I think there are some real significant ways we structure our government that could really make this a citizens' legislature and not just in name.
Beyond signing bills into law, how can the governor improve Mainers' lives?
I think that the governor is responsible for setting the tone about who we are and has the opportunity to bring out the best in Maine. This is the fundamental reason, Fred, that I am running. I believe that what we concentrate on is what we get more of, right? So if all we've done for the last 8 years is talk about what's terrible in Maine, we get more of it. We concentrate, we think of it. I want to be a governor who is not only Maine's biggest cheerleader, but I want to raise up the extraordinary things that people are doing and that are happening in the state. And it is so exciting. I've been at some things where I literally walk out of meeting people and seeing what they're doing, whether it's an artist in Brunswick or Green Drinks I went to last night in Portland, where all these young people are supporting nonprofits and local farmers who have moved here and are reinvigorating their communities and their granges. And, you know, there is such exciting things happening. So imagine if we had a governor who every week or every day lifted up someone or something or some project that was exciting and new and innovative and really fit with the values of Maine people, we would all feel really good. We would feel really good about it and say, oh, yes, we can do this. We could get back to that sort of can-do attitude. You know, I'm the youngest of 5 kids, and my mother was the biggest can-do person. She never said, oh, I can't do that. She never said no. She only said how. And so I think literally having a governor who says, yes, this is hard, this is real, but we are going to do this. We're going to figure this out, and we're going to figure it out together, and we're going to make it happen. And then here are the great people. Look at these incredible people in Maine who are extraordinary, extraordinary service people, extraordinary ideas, extraordinary innovators, extraordinary hard workers. Look at what's going on in our state. It is amazing. And that is going to bring people together in our communities. We've lost our community spirit, I think, in so many ways. And it's going to bring other people from out of state to want to come to be here. I think, you know, I'm an optimistic, energetic person, and I think that is exactly what it's called for.
Looking at roads and bridges for a moment, Maine gets failing grades for its
infrastructure
and its backlog of deferred maintenance. bipartisan proposals to contend with this problem have gone nowhere. So instead we get transportation bonds asked of the voters. Is that sustainable? If not, how would you go about approaching the roads and bridge issues?
I think it's a piece. It's I think there's three things. I think bonding is a piece of it. You should release those bonds, for one. But I think it's a small piece of it. I think we have to look at the gas tax. When we stopped indexing the gas tax is when our roads really started to go into disrepair. And believe me, traveling the roads around the state, we are in crisis in terms of our infrastructure, which not only affects us as individuals, it affects our ability to do business and get our commodities and the things we produce here to other places. So I think that is. And then we have to deal with the issue of, hopefully, the increasing issue of electric vehicles, which I fully support. And I'm so excited. And, you know, seeing charging stations going up all over the state is great. But those vehicles then are not using gas, but they are using the roads. So we have to figure out a mechanism to make sure that they pay a share. I think we can, you know, I think there's a lot of different options. The other thing is we have to look at, I think, ways to capitalize on the people who drive to this state from out of state and use our roads in the summertime as tourists. So I think those are some of the options that we have, but we've got to do something because it is reaching a critical stage.
What are Maine's three greatest assets, and how would you leverage those qualities to improve the economy here?
Our people's work ethic, our people's compassion for one another, and our natural resources. And I think that the hard work and the kindness and compassion that we have as a state is something that make people want to be here. They make people want to stay here. They strengthen our communities. And if we just allow people the opportunity to come together to work on common problems, that happens. Our natural resources, we can be both the breadbasket and the energy basket for all of New England, and we can become a destination place in our tourism as well. So I think those three things are the things that are our future. And then, of course, our delicious, wonderful young people.
Betsy Sweet, one of seven Democrats in this year's gubernatorial primary. She spoke with Maine Public's Fred Bever. If you missed either of the candidate interviews in this past hour, you can hear all 14 conversations at mainepublic.org/yourvote. You can also learn more about each of the candidates and see their positions broken down on an easy-to-use issues grid near the top of our Your Vote page. I'm Keith Shortall. Thanks for listening.